Let me add my welcome to all of you. Welcome to the Church of Christ, and welcome to the 13th Annual Church Lectures. We're glad for all of those who are here in person. Of course, we're mindful of those who are viewing over the internet, and we're also mindful of those who hopefully in future years will be reviewing recordings of these lessons, and to you, we appreciate your interest in God's Word. Topic for this year's lectures is studies in Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. This first session is an introduction to the man Solomon and his writings. If we step back in a broad view and look at the history of Israel, surely the reign of Solomon is one of the high points, a zenith of national power, influence, prestige for Israel. And of course, the key character in that reign was the man Solomon himself. We want to look at the power, the influence of his kingdom, the splendor of the temple as one example of his several building projects, the wisdom of the king. We need to talk about his demise. And we want to talk about the unique literature of his kingdom, literature that brought glory to the man Solomon, brought glory to his kingdom, and ultimately did and continues to bring glory to the heavenly king. First, his kingdom. Because a kingdom is not evaluated solely on size, but also based on its influence, the kingdom of Solomon was a great kingdom. One of the distinguishing features of Solomon's kingdom would be that he would be the first and the last monarch to grow up in a completely unified Hebrew nation. And there were factors that aided that. One was some of the traditional powers of the area, the Hittites, the Egyptians, the Assyrians, and the Babylonians, had an unusually weak period in their histories about this time. Of course, another factor is his father, King David. A lot of the security and the peacefulness of Solomon's kingdom can be attributed to the military victories and the leadership of his father. Among Solomon's siblings, though, there was not the same kind of calm atmosphere. In David's household, among Solomon's siblings was found rape, murder, and finally, when it was about time for Solomon to assume the throne of his father David, there was an attempted coup to try to get somebody else to be king. The coup was defeated when Bathsheba, along with Nathan, acted quickly to remind David that he had already promised the kingdom to Solomon. And indeed, it seemed clear that he had. David had given instructions about the building of the temple. He had given those instructions to his son Solomon, and he said, "The Lord hath chosen thee to build an house for the sanctuary." The coup failed. Solomon became king. And in fact, there's a couplet of verses that describe the end of David and the beginning of Solomon's reign. 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 10 and 12. "So David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. Then sat Solomon upon the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was established greatly." And it was indeed a great kingdom. Solomon's kingdom lasted about 40 years from 971 to 931. 971 to 931 B.C. This first section would show the territory that existed under King Saul, show the way that it was expanded under King David, and an additional territory that was controlled by Solomon. It's important to point out that this perimeter is not necessarily the extent of the land that was occupied by the Israelites, but it represented the sphere of Solomon's influence. Some of those were vassal states. They were allowed to have their own autonomy locally, but as is indicated in the scriptures, they paid their tribute to Solomon. And this strong position of influence, respected for its power, allowed the new King Solomon really to be less concerned with military forces and military battles, and allowed him to concentrate more on his commercial enterprises. It's interesting to me, they had a navy, but the navy was staffed by sailors from other countries, and in the end, one of the main uses of the navy was in the commerce. Solomon acquired horses for his horsemen and his chariots, but it seemed like the primary interest that he had in horses was a part of his trading business. He appears to have had a fine collection of armor, but a lot of that armor was gold, seemed to be more for show than it was for actual use. I thought there was an interesting quote in the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. It said, "Solomon was very literally a merchant prince. He was, in fact, the predominant, if not the sole partner, in a great trading concern." That great trading concern was nothing less than the Israelite nation. One factor that contributed to the military strength as well as the economic and commercial success of Israel was its strategic location. It was located there between the mountains and the sea and controlled a lot of the travel routes, controlled a lot of the trade routes. And when we begin to think about how important that geographic position was to Israel's power, to Israel's influence, I think we need to stop and remember that it was God who picked out that location. This land was the promised land. The land indeed to which God sent Abraham with the promise that someday this land would be occupied by his descendants. I believe one could argue that Solomon's kingdom could never have been as great or as influential without this God-appointed location. And indeed, with few exceptions, the reign of Solomon was a time of peace. 1 Kings 4:24 and 25, he had peace on all sides round about him, and Judah and Israel dwelt safely from Dan even to Beersheba all the days of Solomon. We can talk about Solomon's temple, and again, there were a number of building projects, but the temple was the most visible of those. And this, again, as we look at nations in general, this is one of the characteristics of great nations. They had their building projects. Egypt certainly had its building projects. Babylon, China, so did Israel. And the most visible of those was indeed the temple. One of the reasons that Solomon's reign was a high point in Israel's history was the building of this temple, with all that temple represented of the relationship between God and his chosen people. It was a primary focus. Though the building of the temple was certainly of divine purposing and of divine intentions, it was actually David who proposed the building of the temple. To Nathan, the prophet, David said, "See, now I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwelleth in curtains." 2 Samuel chapter 7. In the ensuing discussion, David was assured by God that Solomon thy son, he shall build my house. David was not allowed to be the one who built the house, but he responded very well to that refusal by God. What he did was he poured his energy into making preparations for the building of the temple. He even began to accumulate much of the great quantity of metals, precious stones that would be used in the building or as a part of its furnishings. But Solomon was the one who built the temple. And maybe it's interesting to read in 1 Kings chapter 8 of the grand ceremony that marked the dedication of that temple. After the temple was completed, the Ark of the Covenant was brought into the temple. Then a cloud, the visible manifestation of the presence of the Lord, filled the temple. Solomon gave a great speech. He prayed a very appropriate prayer. And following that, 22,000 oxen were sacrificed and 120,000 sheep. It's a great ceremony indeed. So we've talked about the kingdom. We've talked about the temple. Now we'll talk about Solomon's wisdom. Surely one of the truly distinctive features of Solomon's reign was his wisdom. How great was his wisdom going to be? God promised him that there would be none like Solomon, neither before him nor after him. And it was interesting how he was given that wisdom. Do we notice that the conversation which resulted in that wisdom was actually a conversation that was initiated by God? God asked, 1 Kings 3:5, "Ask what I shall give thee." Solomon replied, "Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, that I may discern between good and bad. For who is able to judge this, thy so great a people?" 1 Kings 3:9. God was so pleased with Solomon's answer that he gave him not only wisdom, but he gave him riches, honor, and at least the potential for a lengthened life. But what you notice if you read the text carefully is at least the last part of that promise explicitly, maybe the other parts implicitly, were contingent upon, they were conditioned upon him keeping God's commandments. I think the wisdom of Solomon is an interesting topic. The exact meaning of the kind of wisdom that he was going to have, maybe especially the limits of that wisdom. sometimes they're difficult to discern, especially in light of some of Solomon's later behavior. I think it's important to note what the purpose stated in the text is. He was given that wisdom in response to a request for the ability to discern between good and evil in judging the people. And he certainly had that wisdom in judging the people. One of the first examples was the wisdom that he showed in the squabble between two women over a child. Greatly enhanced his reputation for his wisdom in judging the people. However, it might be too much to try to extend that promise of wisdom to some kind of comprehensive wisdom that would guide his every action, that would guide his every decision. And we know there's some definite evidence to the contrary. Solomon's later obsession with wealth, his attraction to strange women, his acquiescence to idolatry. And it seems that the one who gave him that wisdom can be perceived along Solomon's life as giving increasingly firmer guidance to Solomon. After Solomon completed the temple, God appeared a second time to Solomon. And although good things were promised, and that in exchange with God, there is a lengthy warning that the good things for Solomon and the better things for his descendant were conditioned on. They were contingent on his continued integrity of heart, uprightness, and his complete obedience. 1 Kings 9:4. His integrity of heart. It's interesting to notice how many times in God's discussion with Solomon, the focus was on the heart. He is told that he needs to have a heart like his father David. Given the events that followed this warning here, it seems like that the great heart knower understood in advance that there might be some gaps in Solomon's wisdom, or at least a coming lapse of wisdom about Solomon's own behavior. Indeed, in the end, we can talk about Solomon's demise. His reign did not end well. How could a kingdom that was so great, how could a king that was so wise, how could that all not end well? The answer is they failed to follow the warning. They failed to follow the formula. Solomon failed to follow the formula that he was given by God. The formula was to keep the commandments and several times explicitly to follow the example of David, your follower. Seems there are two major areas where Solomon departed from God's instruction. Two major areas. They affected one another. They reinforced one another. One digression was the taking of many wives and concubines. You know, for years, God had repeatedly warned his people, for example, Deuteronomy 7, not to intermarry with the foreign women. Why? Well, there was an explicit warning that the wives of such marriages would turn their sons away from the true God to serving other gods. Deuteronomy 17, there was a specific warning that any future king should not multiply wives. And yet those two things were exactly what Solomon did. And though some have tried, I think it's difficult to justify the many wives solely on the basis of international alliances. Especially when there are statements like 1 Kings 11 that says King Solomon loved many strange women and that Solomon clave to these in love. It's even harder to rationalize away the 300 concubines. First digression, taking of many wives. Second area of digression had to do with him engaging in false worship. And it seems to me that one of the initial steps down that path of false worship was he began to worship the one true God in false ways. Seems like even early in his reign, he began to have mixed allegiance. There is a verse that speaks of his love for the Lord and his loyalty to the Lord. But that verse is immediately followed by the statement that only, that is except, he sacrificed and burnt incense in high places. 1 Kings chapter 3. False worship of the true God. The next stage, he allowed his wives to worship their false gods in the city of Jerusalem, and he aided them in the process. Some of his building projects for temples for the false gods that his wives worshiped. In the end, Solomon built a temple dedicated to idolatrous worship that was within sight of the temple that he had built for the worship of the one true God. Indeed, Solomon's heart had been turned. The scriptures read 1 Kings 11 verses 4 and 5, "For it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after other gods." Just exactly what God had said could happen. There was a third message directly from God to Solomon. It's no longer a warning. That third message was a judgment, a condemnation. 1 Kings 11:11, "Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, for as much as this is done of thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee." The loss of the kingdom was delayed not because of God's affection for Solomon, but because of God's continuing affection for his father David. 1 Kings 11:12. Sad epitaph of Solomon's vaunted career is 2 Kings 1:6, "And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord as David his follower." You know, there's something we always laud and we praise the Bible because of its objectivity. Well, we don't want to lose our objectivity. I think there's something within us that wants to think that Solomon turned out okay in the end. We would like to say, many people, that, well, the things that he wrote in Ecclesiastes toward the end of his life, certainly somehow that superseded this divine condemnation. But I would suggest to you that true repentance on the part of Solomon would have required disposing of those hundreds of wives. History is silent on any such disposal of the wives. Rather, the enduring legacy of Solomon is that it included that measure of overindulgence. And perhaps more tangible, and perhaps in the end more condemning, is the continued existence of those worship places to those strange gods. Later history records that the high places before Jerusalem, which Solomon the king of Israel had built, they were still standing. Days of Josiah, 2 Kings 23, verse 13. Those still standing transgressions of Solomon resulted in the naming of that mount, or at least a part of it, as the Mount of Corruption, 2 Kings chapter 23. To this day, it's known as the Mount of Offense. True repentance could not have let stand those idolatrous places. That brings us to the writings of Solomon. Well, in addition to the greatness of the kingdom, the greatness of the temple, wisdom of the king, the literature of Solomon was one of the traits that gave his kingdom credibility according to the measures given to kingdoms of that era. For those of us who most of our reading of historical documents involves the reading of the Bible, we may not appreciate that the type of literature that is represented by Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon was far from unique to the kingdom of Solomon. This so-called wisdom literature, usually associated with sages or wise men, was common in the ancient Near East. Mesopotamia was found among the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. The wisdom literature of Egypt contains passages that are really, in some cases, very similar to some of the Proverbs. Phoenician wedding song called Wasps, in many ways are similar to the book of the Song of Solomon. Now, both the biblical and the non-biblical literature had a similar focus, the wisdom literature did. It was pondering, you know, difficult questions. It was giving advice for a healthy and happy living. Of course, the distinction of the biblical literature is the divine appointment of and the inspiration of those who wrote them. I put more in the manuscript when you have an opportunity to get the book, defending the authorship of these three books as being written by Solomon. And the fact that they do indeed belong in the canon, that is the list of books that should be in the Bible. One thing that I thought was interesting and showed their acceptance, at least by the Jewish community, is that some of these books were used in conjunction with the Jewish feasts. The Song of Solomon was read during the 8th day of Passover. Ecclesiastes was read during the 3rd day of Tabernacles. I think we can see that the flow of contents across all the books, if we look at them, they do indeed seem to be written by the same hand. And in those books, we can see the different viewpoints. And as will be carried out in this lectureship, many believe that the Song of Solomon was written early in his life, Proverbs, middle life, Ecclesiastes, and later life. To help us prepare for listening to the individual lectures on the books, let me just briefly talk about each of the books. Song of Solomon. There's a lot of information in the first verse of the Song of Solomon. It says, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Well, it identifies Solomon as the author, but that expression, Song of Songs, means the superlative song. We talk about the King of Kings, which is the greatest of kings. So we need to remember that the Song of Solomon is not a collection of songs. It is one song. But it is the best of the songs. How do you describe the book of Song of Solomon? It seems to me in the end, it's kind of a drama that's played out through conversational exchanges. The main characters are the king, Shulamite woman, the country maiden who becomes the bride, the wife, and the chorus. You know, some people have doubted whether the Song of Solomon should even be included in the Bible because of its plain language about sex. But doesn't the inclusion of material like this, doesn't it reassure us that indeed God has given us guidance on all things that pertain to life and godliness? 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 3. Some have suggested that this song in its entirety is an allegory of God's love for Israel. It's an allegory of Christ's love for the church. Personally, I did not see anything in it that really made me believe that that was the case. The kinds of expressions that are used in Song of Solomon, they're nowhere used by the New Testament writers in their writing about the church. The theme, rather, I would say, is the beauty of the emotional and the physical union between a man and a woman who are united in marriage. And knowing of Solomon's later multiplying of wives, it does seem that this song talks about the affection, talks about the excitement of a first marriage, does indeed belong early in his life. Proverbs, our English title Proverbs comes from a Hebrew word that means parallel or similar. So it is a collection of statements that make comparisons or they make contrast. I believe it's very important to realize that a proverb is a statement of a general truth. It is not true at all times in all circumstances. The proud do not always suffer, Proverbs 15. The wise do not always live long lives, Proverbs 3. Many parents have suffered greatly and inappropriately because they tried to accept full responsibility for a child that went astray. Based on Proverbs 22, verse 6, train up a child in the way it should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. It does take some skill, it takes some study to realize the particular viewpoint of a particular proverb and the limiting scope of that proverb. The book describes its own purpose. Its purpose is to give prudence to the inexperienced. We need to remember that. We need to teach ourselves that. We need to teach our children that. The inexperienced people, we do not have to learn through painful experiences. One of the purposes of Solomon is to give prudence to the inexperienced and knowledge and discretion to the youth, Proverbs 1:4. The sayings in this book are not so much meant to be literature as they are teaching tools. How blessed we are to have these great divine truths, this wisdom from above, in this collection of pithy and catchy sayings. The greater base of experience alluded to in the book, it gives us an idea of a more mature person, so probably written after the Song of Solomon, but before the more melancholy reflections of later life that are found in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, our title Ecclesiastes really comes from the title the book was given in the Greek translation. The original Hebrew word does not refer exclusively or even specifically to a preacher. It means a gatherer. And as many of the Hebrew words are, it's broad in its meaning. It could mean a gatherer or a collector of wise sayings, Sometimes it referred to those who gathered a crowd to be able to talk to them. A gatherer. It's very different than Proverbs. It's not short sayings. It's flowing prose. The author of Ecclesiastes is sometimes a narrator, sometimes an autobiographer, sometimes a philosopher, often a philosopher. The book records the progressive thinking of the wise man about his frustrations and satisfactions in life. His progressive ponderings of the frustrations and satisfactions of life until he finally reaches the point where absolute truth is recognized. The reflective nature, personal nature of the things that are there, give reason to point this toward the end of Solomon's life. Song of Solomon in the beginning, Proverbs in the middle, Ecclesiastes at the end. Lessons learned. From the life of Solomon and also his writings, the lessons learned have to do with the heart. Let me suggest to you that one of the lessons we can learn is the dangers of a contaminated heart. There has never been an era of time in which Saul's pointed warning is not valid. Be not deceived. Evil companionships corrupt good morals. 1 Corinthians 15:33 out of the American Standard Version of 1901. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a more alarming illustration of that principle than the life of Solomon. Here was a man. Sometimes, you know, we gather people around us and we want to influence them or have them influence us because we have something to gain from them. That's not the case with Solomon. Solomon had so much power, he did not have to live his life to please anybody. And yet he was vulnerable to the influences of those around him. I would suggest to you the digression of Solomon, maybe it follows the usual pattern, which is just as much a danger to us today. First, he became close to those who did not share his values, the evil companionship. And then he began to tolerate their values. He assisted their values. Then he adopted their values. And in the end, he abandoned his own values. Be not deceived. Evil companionship corrupts good morals. Contaminated heart. Let's talk about a divided heart. If anybody was ever in a position to have both wealth and righteousness before God without there being a conflict between the two, surely it was Solomon. He had an overabundance of wealth, overabundance of glory. But alas, that was not the case. Solomon had divided allegiances. And we see in the life of Solomon that this particular malady, this disease of a divided heart, is doubly dangerous for leaders. When Solomon allowed his faith to be divided, then that helped destroy the unity of the faith of the people of Israel. That compromised their unity. That weakened them as a nation. And looking at this, maybe we reflect about our own nation. And I think there's a tendency for every generation to say, woe is me, things are worse than they've ever been. We see our vulnerabilities magnified. But I would challenge you to pick another time in our nation's history when a divided religious faith has so weakened our nation as it is now. One more illustration. I've called it the danger of a compartmentalized heart. Maybe it's an advanced stage of a divided heart. A compartmentalized heart, a person that seems to say this thing with one part of his heart, something entirely different with another part. I think by now we're accustomed to the hypocrisy of people who say one thing for political purposes, but they practice something else in their life. But the dichotomy, the conflict within Solomon seems to go much deeper than that. It is as if one part of his heart had truly cut off communication with the other part. When we read the writings of Solomon, and we compare that to the events in his life, we're astounded that they could both be true of the same person at the same time. Scriptures are silent of any pang of conscience in his behavior. Any pang of conscience that his behavior was so different than the biblical principles that he so famously wrote about. Seems to me this is not lukewarmness. This is hot and cold coexisting within the same person. I think this may be the most dangerous of all heart conditions. We see it in the life of Solomon. I think we see it in the lives of those around us. We know of the preachers who preach so eloquently about moral values, and then we find later that they're involved in multiple illicit affairs. There are authors who talk about the need for integrity, and then we find they've engaged in plagiarism to advance their own social goals. The people who, on the one hand, write so eloquently of the love that should exist among brethren, and then apparently with the same pen, they write horrible things about those who share being in the body of Christ. We see those who write of the importance of humility, and yet in their lives we see the pride and the arrogance. We see it in Solomon. We see it in those around us. I'm thinking, at least for me, we better be watching for it in ourselves. This idea of a compartmentalized heart, maybe it's the most dangerous of all the heart conditions. What a stir there would be. What a stir there would be in the media if this city were visited by a famous man who was reputed to be the wisest man of all times. The photographers, the paparazzi would be there trying to snap a picture. Everybody would be pressing him, trying to ask at least one question. And if you could get the published results of the questions and the answers, surely that would top the bestseller list. In the books of Proverbs, Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes, we have all that and more. In these books, we have the answers to some of the most meaningful questions of life. But we have something better than that. Because not only are the answers composed by the wise man, the questions are composed by the wise man also. He asks the questions that we would not be wise enough to ask. And in the end, both the questions and the answers are from God himself. We must not let these books gather dust on our shelves. Let us take advantage of the opportunities this week to look deeply into these books and to drink deeply of the divine wisdom that's found within them. We hope to see you all at every opportunity. Thank you very much.